Do you like my under eye
She's
thingies?
trying to divert from the fact we've been talking shit for the past 20 minutes,
We
which
have. Well, I just figured we would start with
the
my
fact
eye patches.
that I couldn't see you, so I had to get glasses and my hair's gray. What in the hell are we doing?
You have a very deep academic vibes happening because you've got like the books and the plaid and the
Yeah.
glasses and the bun.
I do have a University of Glasgow sweatshirt
You have
on.
the University of Glasgow.
Gives me a little bit of youth, but that's about it right now.
Yeah,
Ayn Rand is still on the shelf, so I didn't learn much from last time.
I
How my drink? Did you make your drink?
did. Are you excited?
Maybe.
Did you?
I didn't make mine, so I don't know.
I mean,
Is it a
it
Talisker
looks.
glass?
Oh, good job. It mine's not in the right glass, but
Oh, that's real good. I like that.
yeah, that is good. Did you
Got
make? Did you make? You didn't make it. You don't know what yours is. Stuart made your drink for you.
What do you mean? I can have this lime just like this. I spent the whole day making drinks for
You
people.
did. You did.
I got home and he was like, "Are you gonna?" I was like, "Nope, my drink making days are done." I watched the whole of North Charlotte get drunk today, day drunk today, and I was like,
I can imagine.
"Absolutely not. Am I doing anything?"
Just listeners, we're drinking a drink called The Passion
Fashion.
because it's in our Drinking with the Saints book and it's for Easter.
Yeah, we're in Holy
Since
Week.
it's Good Friday of Holy Week, and
Are
so it felt really appropriate. I can't come up with words.
you drink multiples of these?
Was
Were you at the bar today?
I at the bar all day? No, sadly. I wish I was.
I did get told no less than like 400 times today, and it was really funny because each person thought they were the first person, and I'm really good at acting like that's true.
Yeah.
That Easter is on 420. It was
That's
so many people told me that, and
amazing.
I was like, okay. So North Carolina has this weird law. It's called the Farm Act. Those of you who are from here will know. And it was about tobacco, right? And it
Okay.
was supposed to make it much easier for like the Tar Heels to be Tar Heels, but it's called the Farm Act. Anyway, so it put a lot of freedom for farmers. Well, now in 2025, it's still doing that, but the farmers have changed. But what's so funny is that basically the state can't do anything because they put forth this act that gave people a lot of freedom. Anyway, point being is that weed is basically legal in North Carolina right now.
That's amazing.
It's a different strand than the federal government, but like says no to, but like because of the Farm Act, we can still have it. And it's still weed.
It's still,
It's weed by another name. So fast forward to everyone comes in and they're just like, yeah, they're just giving me the whole rigmarole
That's
of about
fantastic.
420 being, and they're like, which one are you going to celebrate more? And I was like, probably Easter. And they were like, and I was like, I mean, I'm 42. I'm not, you do what you want. I don't care. But like, honestly, like you got told your whole life that drugs are bad. And then like, all of a sudden they're like, oh no, it's okay. You just got to drink it. Now we have THC drinks and everything. Wow. They're just like, fine.
I went to the liquor store today because I had to get some of the ingredients for this here drink. And there was a couple of women who were doing like samplings of liquor alcohols. And
And
one of
you
them,
drank them all.
I drank them all. No, one of them had cans of something.
Yeah.
And upon like I was walking towards that one because I needed to go in the aisle like by her. And I immediately was like, oh, I bet those are THC cans. And then I looked down and they were not. They were vodka. And I was like, why did I just assume that they were THC? Like, what?
To me, I don't know. Or I mean, your friends in Colorado,
I
between
know.
your friends in North Carolina and Colorado, you're like THC'd out.
I'm just like, surely.
Do they have THC seltzers in Florida?
I have no idea.
Probably no, then you would have seen them.
I would have seen them. You would think that I would have seen them. I've not seen
Can I
anything.
say
I
they're
know.
everywhere? They're
Yeah,
everywhere.
like I know there obviously are a lot in Colorado.
Yeah.
And I have seen them in North Carolina when I'm visiting you. So like I feel like I would have seen them here, but I have not. I've never seen them. So I'm assuming no,
Watching
but
people decide whether to get drunk or to get high is a hilarious thing. I've seen them go back and forth, and they're like, oh, am I gonna get high? Am I gonna get drunk? Yeah, well, some people also do that. And
yeah.
That was always my issue. Well, I won't dig into that. In my sober January, where I partook of some of these seltzers, let's put it in the legal realm, is that I would just always fall asleep. Like, it was just,
yeah,
I was tired.
I mean, I know I've told you this before, but I feel like I probably have said this. I am a bad Coloradan because weed just, I fall asleep immediately, but then I also have the worst hangover of my life for a solid 24 hours.
If you drink alcohol and that?
No, if I have any kind of weed, really? Like any of it, any forms, and like, not to sound like, you know, a pothead, but like, I've tried a few because... Well,
I mean, you're not.
I'm from Colorado. I lived there for a long time.
It's legal in Colorado. And
you know, so.
Here.
But yeah, no, it just, every time I feel like I have the flu for the whole next 24 hours. Well, it's not pleasant. So I don't do it, but it's been years since I've even tried because it's like deeply horrific for me.
Well, guys. Welcome to Theology on the Rocks.
Welcome to Theology on the Rocks.
And if you know that.
But I was the other day, I was listening to a Who album on my record player. And I was sitting there thinking, like,
1974, just saying.
I was just sitting there thinking, man, I wish that I could smoke some pot right now.
It's funny because doing it legally via the seltzers, like, it really is far less sort of, well, I don't, and this is from my own perspective, listeners, but it felt far less of a thing than alcohol, you know?
Yeah, that's what I've heard from other people too.
I immediately fell asleep. So.
I fall asleep super fast and then I feel like death for 24 hours. So I am not the right person to ask. But in my head, there's an experience that I have never had because obviously, but that it's really pleasant and that you get to kind of like be really chill. And I want, you know, what I want is to recreate some kind of like 70s situation of like sitting and listening to Tommy and having some candles lit and, you know, but this is a real, like, I wish that it was 1968 kind of situation happening.
I feel like we have to shift the convo away from weed, away from the Reverend Doctor's
Somehow our good Friday chat.
You know, I say that, but we drink on the show and there is a real debate, like, I think about, you know, what kills people more, like drinking and driving, or, you know, or whatever. We, you know, I think there are real debates about what we consider to be socially acceptable and what is not. And
I completely agree.
I think it's interesting because hearing some of the debates in North Carolina, I'm like, you know, literally you guys, our whole state made all of its money on tobacco.
Right.
There's, you know, they're called the Tar Heels for a reason. Like, it is.
Let's talk about something that's bad for you, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, but don't do that. But like, and see, that's, I think that's the funny thing is that it's been legal in Colorado for so long that it doesn't always occur to me to not just like openly talk about it. You know, well, I'm just like, just, la, la, are you uncomfortable? I'm so sorry.
That's it. I mean, you can go into my bar right now that I've talked about on the show and buy 10 milligrams of THC in a seltzer can if you want. So, and it's perfectly legal to do that. Like, there's a can that they sell, not at my store but at a different place, that's 100 milligrams. 100, I might die.
I would for sure die.
But I do think it is interesting, like, how
I agree.
What thing is, you know,
well, and to bring it back to a few episodes, we did have Dr. Jamie Clark Souls on here talking about.
Yeah. I appreciated how openly she talked about that.
And I'm really interested in all of those kinds of discussions. And I've seen a few, AAR has posted a few of the books on the use of psychedelics and spirituality. And I was also talking to a colleague that's in a totally different area about this kind of growing thing. It's not just this one field, but it's in like anthropology and other places too. So, you know, it ongoing, how do we understand what things we moralize and what things we shouldn't moralize and stuff like that.
Yeah, I do the student papers at AAR Southeast, and last year it was all about drugs.
Yeah.
Drugs were like drugs and spirituality, drugs and religion. It's funny because I've done it for 3 years now, and you can kind of see the the like trends, which is actually quite helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this year was very much media. Like, I think there was a lot more media. I told you that there was a student who did a paper on theology, history, and like vampire films and stuff.
Yeah. Which yeah. I would just die. Really, I would love. That'd be so cool. Because you said they were talking about like Nosferatu and
yeah, to Twilight and
to how, Twilight, yeah,
how the sort of, you know, of course there's a history we know of anti-immigration and stuff. But
yeah.
I don't know if it was Semitism, it was anti-immigration or whatever with some
general
of the early
xenophobia, yeah,
over the early films, and then how all of a sudden you see in Twilight the vampires become this like moral, quote unquote, moral center because you get Stephanie Meyer or whatever. Mormon writing, you know, he wants to marry her before they have sex and all of this stuff, and yeah. The early vampires were seen as like sexually promiscuous and all.
Well, you know, and I've been doing a rewatch of both Buffy and Angel,
mm-hmm.
and it's super interesting to watch. It's been years since I've watched Angel, but it is always interesting to watch because like there's a whole like anti-sex aspect to Buffy for a while because that's how Angel loses his soul and becomes evil, and
because he had sex.
Because he had sex with Buffy. Buffy and Angel had sex, and Angel lost his soul and became Angelus, his evil side.
Oh, I've really not watched enough of this.
But they do. They have a lot of kind of weird moralizing in the show. But then it's also like fairly progressive in other areas, so it kind of flips back and forth in certain respects.
She did a really excellent job of going through. So she even talked about like the 80s, like Lost Boys and stuff. Like,
yeah, oh God, Lost Boys.
Right?
It was ages.
A really, really well thought out. I mean, shout out to Elon University because she was at Elon and they seem to have very good research students there. But yeah, it was a really good paper. And I just was sitting there being like, you are an undergraduate.
I love when that happens.
Yeah. And the papers, yeah, they are really good at the AR Southeast. Big advocate of that. But So guys, today we have decided we're drinking our passion drink. It is Good Friday.
It's Good Friday.
We're going to talk not about weed and not about vampires. That's just your fun banter. Although Christy and I would love to talk about both of those things with you. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about what I learned to be called theologies of reconciliation, atonement theology as well. And basically the question of, you know, we're on the day that Jesus dies in the Holy Week mm-hmm. calendar. Also, we learned that Wednesday was Ugly Wednesday, just so you know.
Ugly Wednesday.
We both had no idea what the Wednesday but we're going to talk about, yeah, why did Jesus have to die? What is this? Because it's a big question, but it felt kind of appropriate. I write about it a little bit in my reconciliation book because I do the systematic history and then how it evolved into more of a practical thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go through and look at some of those early theologies of reconciliation. And they're interesting, depending on where you want to hitch your wagon. But also just the sort of overall, I think, philosophical idea and a question that I used to get a lot and still do, honestly, in some of my theology classes is, if we have this omniscient God, why would God pick this to happen, basically, or choose this to happen? And it is, you know, we can Calvin it away, or we can, you know, Bard it away and say, you know, Jesus is the answer and we had to have this happen. But did we have to have this happen? I mean, that is a question. Like,
I think it's a good question.
Yeah.
No, I think because especially one of the things that I used to teach when I taught systematic theology was the 9 different atonement theories. And like, how do we, I used to be able to like just ramble them right off, and I had to look them up because it has been a few years. But
I know that there was like the good versus evil.
I looked it up. So there's the satisfaction theory, that Jesus satisfied God's wrath,
which has
this was posited.
Go ahead.
This is posited by Anselm primarily.
Christy does a research. I just show up from a bar.
I've just had time.
But also I think so, but I want to point out the satisfaction was because Jesus or God was mad at humanity.
Yes.
Which an all loving God.
Well, I don't want to say, I think feeling like mad at humanity isn't quite right. It's like wrath towards sin is more it. And if you're thinking about...
Right, but humans are committing the sin.
I mean, yes. I do agree with your, like, final conclusion. I want to kind of affirm I don't buy into the satisfaction theory. But the idea isn't that God is mad at humanity, but God has wrath towards sin. And so as humans are sinful, God is unable to, like, be present in that. And so something had to satisfy, which Anselm's kind of idea was that Jewish custom was sacrifices to satisfy that. And then Jesus... is the ultimate sacrifice to satisfy that.
But then God created humans that committed sin, and they were created in God's image. So God is also sinful?
No, they were created with free will to sin, but God has never sinned. So therefore, we just took two different paths. Got it.
This is not me taking apart, Christy. This is me just all this stuff. But anyway, okay. So we've got satisfaction.
Satisfaction. There's the penal substitution, which to this day, one of my students wrote a whole paper where he spelled it penile the entire time. And I have to tell you, that was amazing to read through. Penal substitution is the idea that God had to punish somebody. And so Jesus took the punishment for us.
I almost think that's worse than the previous.
I also think it's worse. I don't like the satisfaction theory, but I do think that the penal substitution theory is worse. But my least favorite is the ransom theory. And the ransom theory says that we have been imprisoned by Satan. He's taken us prisoner. And Jesus is the ransom paid to Satan to free us.
Oh yeah, that's not right.
Right? It's terrible.
Because that just makes God like infinitely small.
Yeah, and it makes Satan some kind of like boogeyman who can kidnap us. I mean, it's just all, there's a whole bunch of bad, stupid things going on with that one.
Sorry to that man who wrote about it, but I remember there was one that's like, it was like a medieval one where it was like there was this cosmic battle between good and evil. Jesus was the victor.
Maybe Christus Victor. So there's Christus Victor, yep. Which actually was coined by Gustav Aulén in 1931. Okay. He was a Swedish theologian. But he said that it was the historical position. So he was really angry at people saying that he came up with it because he was like, no, this is the historical position.
I knew it to be quite early on.
But so it's got like very historical roots, but it is a kind of offshoot of the ransom theory in that Jesus, God pretends. So basically what I am bastardizing this really quickly, but God basically... Satan still has us prisoner, and God is like, sure, I'll pay your ransom. But like Jesus is God. So then God comes down and then just defeats Satan rather than paying a ransom to Satan.
I feel like the Trinity goes out the window a little bit with some of these theories.
I think that the non-hierarchical Trinity definitely goes out the window with some of these theories, because it's like God the Father is a super angry asshole and Jesus is like, I'll save the humans.
Right. It seems to seems to make Jesus.
And where's the Spirit?
Whatever the Spirit's doing. It seems to make Jesus a very separate entity in the midst of all of this.
Yeah. So I'm not a fan of any of those. I used to think that Christus Victor was the best of them, and I think that there's aspects that aren't, like when you read through it, you're like, okay, I get what he's trying to say, because it's trying to be like, he's the victor, you know, like.
Yeah.
But how many is that? Four? I'm not going to get all nine. There's the moral influence theory, in which Jesus is a moral influence for us. And therefore, Jesus, in kind of a consequence to how he lived, was put to death. But it wasn't like God intending that to happen.
But you know me, it's not surprising that I sort of lend myself, I think, to that one a little bit.
Yeah. More. There's the reconciliation theory, which is that the atonement actually happens at the incarnation. And that God's incarnation is what reconciles us. And therefore, the death is not actually the part of the reconciliation. But because, again, similar to the moral influence, the way that Jesus lived, like the natural consequences of his life led to his death. So the death isn't necessary, but it's just kind of practically.
Why did we have to get reconciled?
Because sin broke us from God, so we had to get reconciled. I'm missing...
Well, I think three of them. You've done a great job, because I very much am basing this off of my writing about it for about 2 pages, and then also like 10 years, well, 15 years ago, and then seminary. So I think you've done
you're welcome
very I, well, I mean,
reaching into the systematic side of my brain for a moment.
I mean, they all sound kind of trash. I don't, but I mean, not, I mean, here's what I'll say about the systematic stuff. You guys have heard me sort of like moan and groan about it. It's not that I don't think the exercise is helpful. It's that I think you have to find how it, this is very humanist to me, but how it works for you in a way, because I don't think any of this is right. Like, I think there's 9 theories.
There are 9 theories. There's also, so there are theory methods that also go along with these 9 theories, in which you can take one theory as being correct and the others as all being wrong. Or you can take one theory as being correct with a kind of supporting second theory. Or my favorite is the kaleidoscope theory, in which all of them have aspects of truth. Nobody is surprised by the fact that I like the one where you don't have to make a decision.
We have really come to that conclusion on this podcast.
I'm like, yes, that one. That one. I appreciate some of the conversation around them. And I have always, since really kind of becoming someone who thinks like, okay, I have firm stances on aspects of theology, I have kind of rooted myself in the reconciliation, because I think the idea that we have had some kind of a break, which I think makes sense to me, how you would like to like define sin and all that is a different conversation, but like there's a broken relationship that needs to be mended, and that God is the one that's going to reach out and do that. And I think that what the reconciliation theory does that I appreciate so much is that it locates it in the entirety of the incarnation. So like it's the birth, life, and subsequent death. So it's not like Jesus just had to die. Because I always thought that those theories where like Jesus's death was the primary thing was like, but what if he, I mean, he lived for like 33 years. So like what about all that stuff? And like, you know, the majority of the gospels are about the living part, not the death.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I have some issues with the creation aspect. I do, to go back to that is, you know, I feel like with creation theology, how do we, not to use the word reconcile, you know, this need for reconciliation with the thing that created us that assumably knew, I don't know. I just think with a lot of these theory, I talked about this earlier, but like, it just limits God in a way in terms of creation, because it's this idea of like, so we have to be reconciled to a thing that made us. And because we sinned, okay, and yeah, you can say whatever version of that you want, but like, didn't God set up the world that we would sin in?
I had some students ask me the other day, because we were going over creation stories, and we were mostly talking about it from a Judaism perspective, but they're like, why did God put the tree in the garden if we weren't allowed to eat from it? And I was like, I think that's a good question. And I told them, I said, the way you answer that question is going to depend on a couple of things. One is like, what do you believe about the literalness of this story? You know, like, because if it literally happened, then yes, I think we have a really big, like, why did you put a tree in the garden that we weren't supposed to eat from? Like, that's like, if I put, well, not this dog, because she doesn't like to eat anything, but like, with my last dog, Lizzie.
Zero.
Yeah. Like if I put, you know, a piece of chocolate in front of him, I was like, don't eat this.
He's going to absolutely.
He's going to eat that because, you know, dog. But I think.
Jewish traditions, they're trying to explain why humanity is crap. And I think some of these stories, I think, give it, well, not to take away from the God aspect, but it does give them a way to do that.
I think that's kind of what I said to the students too, is if it's not a literal story, and instead you're just talking about the fact that there's a broken world, and you're trying to kind of give some structure to that chaos of brokenness in the world, and then you're like, but also we believe in a God who cares about us and interacts with us and intervenes for us, is Jewish theology demonstrates, you know, then we have to figure out like, okay, so obviously something about our relationship got broken in there. So like, this is a good story to demonstrate what got broken. Right. And it's not really about like, he gave us a tree to eat or to not eat from, and we ate from the tree, but like humans did something that broke the relationship. And I talked to the students about like, if it's a tree of knowledge, then what you're talking about is that humans are trying to become God.
Yeah.
Right. And so you're kind of breaking in that. I don't know that this helps with like this whole conversation, but I do think it's something we have to think about. Like,
well,
how did that brokenness,
because of the these are two different traditions.
Yeah.
That we have
absolutely
spliced together here. And it's taking seriously the Jewish perspective and saying we definitely appropriated a bunch of texts and then use the same systems of analysis that we use with our own texts to texts that didn't operate under that system. We just wanted them to. Yeah. And I think that's really important too. Like, you know, I think about Noah's Ark and how God changed God's mind. And it's like about humanity.
Yeah. God's like,
okay. Changes Leah's mind about humanity on a daily basis, maybe on a minute basis.
But I do, also,
it's an interesting thing because I think we're analyzing a lot of this stuff based on, yeah, two very different setups and systems, understanding of stories and analogy. And like when we do talk about this reconciliation stuff, you know, we want to trace it back to, well, at least I do. I want to trace it back to, well, who is God? What is God in all of this? And I think that's where my mind always goes. And to do that, you know, God doesn't disappear in the New Testament, but my Lord, I mean, God is in like God, the third version of this made up Trinity thing, is that God sure does disappear a lot. And you could say, oh, God's incarnate in Jesus. Okay, cool. But the figure of God, as we know, like from the clouds, you know, burning bushes and stuff, just as a character, if you want to call it, disappears from the text quite a bit in the New Testament. And it's like, I base a lot of my understanding of God the Father on the Old Testament, because that's where I think we see more of this version. And I guess you could say, again, you could say God's the Son is God, but then that gets complicated because you're killing someone to reconcile yourself to the thing that you're killing.
See, this is just why I think the reconciliation theory is the one that works all of this out, though, is that it's not intention. Like, God isn't saying like, okay, the thing to reconcile God's self with humanity is by killing a part of God. God is saying, I need to reconcile with humanity. Mm-hmm. And therefore I'm going to become humanity in order to do that, so that I can reach down to them in a physical form and take on experience and understanding and empathy and all that. And in that, God understands that the risk is that humanity will reject God.
Yeah.
As always, as we already do, you know, in that rejection, God will then get killed.
Yeah.
I think that's the more appropriate way to understand what's going on, because humans killed Jesus. God didn't kill Jesus. And then what God is doing is saying, like, I'm willing to risk that death in order to reconcile, because I need to come down and reconcile. God knows that that's the risk and that it's likely to happen. And then it does. Like,
right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's true. I don't think I could adhere to a theology where it was that God, yeah, like the, where that like version that you just gave makes total sense, except for one aspect. And again, this is why I went back to the creation thing, is if God is all-knowing, which is something that folks say, God had to know that this was going to be the end result. And God was okay with this disconnect?
Which I think is an unsolvable problem, because we can't know this, right? Like, we can't say, I know, like, some people are like, oh, well, it had to be because of...
It's just that I don't
know
that part. I don't understand, just from my perspective.
But I mean, again, I think this is like the most common question, is like, why did God create a world where evil exists, right?
Yeah.
What is it? The theodicy problem is,
theodicy.
If you have a good God who's all powerful and all loving, then why does evil exist? And then there's all of the like, okay, well, maybe it's the free will defense, like, God had to create us with free will, or else we would just be robots, you know? And that essentially is that risk, or it's that, oh gosh, what is it? Augustine said that it's the, I'm going to lose the actual word for it, but essentially, like, by having to go through the process of like suffering and all that, we get closer to God. And then it's like, we become better people because we've suffered, which neither of us like.
I'm gonna give a
thumbs down to that.
Which makes sense for Augustine, actually.
I was like, it's a very Augustine thing.
He didn't lean on the sunny side of life.
He was like, I'm trash. Everyone is trash.
He is. Let's all just go climb up the steps on our knees of the church.
Let's start whipping ourselves. There's a liberation theology that's like suffering exists and God also suffers and we're supposed to stop suffering, you know?
And I teach like liberation theology and I find that a little problematic too.
I don't know how to answer that though. Like, I mean, because essentially the question becomes, if you think, if the idea of, which I know a lot of people come to this conclusion, and that's entirely fair, but if you think that, if you follow those lines that it's an all-powerful God who is all-loving and evil exists, like, and then that has to, like, one of those things has to kind of cancel out God, essentially. And I know that that's where a lot of people land, but I don't know. I don't know that there's any way for us to be like, I have proven it.
Well, no, but we can't prove any of this.
We can't prove anything.
All of this is made up. And it's not made up in a sad way, made up in a logical, philosophical way based on text and reasoning, but it is still human construction, which is absolutely fine because it's what we have. And I think it is valuable to have these theories and theologies. Like, that's the one thing, because someone asked me recently, they're like, well, if it's all made up, then you don't really care. And I'm like, no, I need it.
Yeah.
It's still there. It's not that I don't, it's just that it always feels like we're grasping at something that's just out of reach, you know?
I think that, like, for me, it's not so much, I was actually, I was reading through a text that I have on Christian mysticism, and it was talking about some of the early mystics talking about negation, and that what we can say definitively are things that God is not. But what we can't do is say definitively things that God is.
That's Thomas Aquinas, right?
Aquinas picks up on it later, but the textbook is too far away from me to get.
Oh, God. Christy and I are going into our deep, dark Rolodex of.
The Rolodex. So Aquinas picks up on it, but the book was talking about the fact that there's people prior to Aquinas, and it's like Gregory of Nyssa, and but it was also like, I mean, obviously a lot of this is also pulling from Neoplatonism and Plotinus and stuff. So it's like, you know, you have to understand the Greek philosophical aspects of this too. But essentially they're saying like, we can't know enough about God because God is ineffable. God is unknowable. We can't know enough about God to say anything positively, but we can know things that God is not. So like, God is not evil. God is not a liar. God is not this or that. And Aquinas uses it to be like, well, if we only can know things that God isn't, this helps me to understand who God is, right? Or like parts of that.
Yeah.
But the mystics were like, actually, it's just very comfortable to sit in the fact that we don't know things.
Yeah, the mystery.
Like, they're like, we don't know who God is. And that, like, we know these things that God is not. And then we're kind of in this like unknowable bubble.
It's my most.
And they're like, this is a comfortable spot.
It's my most Catholic jealousy. Is that they love to talk about a good mystery of God. And they are.
I love it. I think, I mean, you know.
You're Anglican. Of course you do. Well, you get your wagon to them.
I tip my toes in Episcopalianism for, but like, you know, that mystical side of me is always like, yeah, like this is it. Like,
right.
Light a candle and light that joint. And then sit there and think about like, what is God?
I think that is definitely the title of this episode. Oh my God. Yeah, no, I think you're right. Like, I think Protestantism doesn't lean itself to that. And we were both raised in these sort of theological worlds where we have to, like,
you have to have an answer.
Why do I know that I haven't taught on Thomas Aquinas. Why is that in my head?
Right.
It's not because I'm smart. It's because we were taught it at some stage.
Yeah.
So we're taught these things. And I think we never lay in, like, yeah, in the mystery of it all.
I think that's the major downfall of Protestantism too, is that there's this need to know exactly what's going on with God. And I was kind of vaguely telling you about this the other day in a message that I'm like, I just don't want to know. I'm not... And not in a like unintellectual way, right? I'm not saying like, oh, I don't care who God is.
But you don't need to know.
But I lived so much of my life in this hyper Calvinist place of if you can't like say, here are all the things that I know I'm right, this is who God is, this is why Jesus died on the cross, like, then you aren't really a Christian, you know, this I must be right. or else none of this matters. And I'm like, it's really nice to be able to say, like, I don't understand why this is happening. I don't understand why God created the world the way that God created the world. But I do understand this other thing, you know, or I can say that, you know, the reconciliation idea teaches me a lot of things about God.
Yeah.
That I feel I can affirm. It doesn't mean I know everything about God, but it means I know enough that I can kind of like sit comfortably in the mystery. I wish Protestants were better at that.
Yeah, no, we want to be right. And even the ones who are, you know, do the deconstruction thing or become ex-evangelicals or whatever, then they create another system, really. It's interesting to me. And we've talked about that before on the podcast. I mean, I think that's right. If we were able to just be okay with it. And I wonder if we talk about our brains being conditioned. I wonder if there's something that, and we all want certainty to an extent, but it does feel like the Catholics are much better with not having that, you know,
it and does.
Being okay with it. And it doesn't make you anti-intellectual. I mean,
no.
Just hearing J.D. Vance try to talk about Thomas Aquinas poorly made me realize that it's not... It's absolutely not anti-intellectualism. It's just being okay with not, they're okay with not knowing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that it's not that I don't want to think about it either. Right. You know, it's not that I don't want to spend time pondering the mysteries of God. It's just that I'm okay with not being able to say like this, but it took a kind of crisis of faith, honestly, like me being like, I'm either out or something else has to be true. Or something else has to start working. And sitting in that Episcopal cathedral in Glasgow with an old Welsh man who used to be Nelson Mandela's bodyguard, swinging a ball of incense like his life depended on it, and just like, you know, shooting glitter cannons at Mary and stuff like that, and just having a kind of be like, we don't need all of the answers. We just need to sit here in community. I was like, this helps. This is fixing a piece of my brokenness, you know?
There's two things about Good Friday, because this is the question I was going to ask you, is what is your best Good Friday memory? The alcohol caught up with me in that introduction. So there's two things I wanted to say. One was my Southern Baptist church. We used to have a full-on like Calvary play, passion play situation.
Yes.
With a giant cross. I had no idea where they kept it in the off days that weren't Easter.
Yeah.
My grandma would make us all come to church and we would sit there. But I was actually a part of the passion play with my grandfather. There's one tiny little Polaroid of a public access television because they would put it on public access. And he would read me the story of the death of Jesus, not the birth, the death.
Oh my God.
And in the background, there was like this, there was Jesus doing things. And then Jesus would come up on the stage while we're reading the story and would climb upon the cross and had like these hangy little hangy things for his arms. And it was a whole situation.
That's
all I've got.
I love that though. That's fantastic.
It was a lot.
It's a lot.
And it's a lot. And there was Roman soldiers. I just remember the budget. I'm like, where? And you never saw this stuff except for Easter. So Easter except was kind of exciting for that reason.
Yeah.
And my grandma always said, may she rest in peace. She was like, you know that it's never a bad weather day when it's Easter. Because Jesus is and I was like,
because Jesus is happy.
Well, she didn't say Jesus is happy. She just said, is there, and I was, because God, you know, it's whatever. And now I think about it theologically and I'm like, okay. I mean, he did rise again. So I guess that makes
sense. He did rise again. I mean, I would be.
The Sunday, not the Friday. So.
The Sunday would be. So this is my favorite/most horrifying story.
I have one more, but you can go.
Okay. It's related to yours.
Okay, go for it.
I didn't attend this church, but there's a very large church in Colorado Springs that puts on this massive passion play. And one year I went.
Was this the demons flying? You told me about this.
The demons. Have I told this on the podcast?
I think you did tell about the flying demons.
They were on wires and they flew into the audience. The demons did.
It's hard to know what we talk about and just what is.
I know. Sometimes if you have heard this before, I'm sorry if you haven't. I'm also sorry.
Crappin'.
Demons flew at us. That was, that, you, I mean, like, it's a favorite memory in its horrifyingness, you know, of being like,
oh my gosh.
What? Okay, what's your next one?
Oh, no, okay. No, I'm still reveling in the demons.
The demons flying at me, yeah.
Were they humans or were they just
like... They were humans. They were human people dressed in demon costumes. They would also run around.
What does a demon costume look
they like? They had like, you know those green man costumes where your whole body is just green, but they were black. And then they had like weird demon-y wings, basically. Okay. So they're just like in black spandex with demon-y wings.
Yeah.
And like some of them were just running throughout the sanctuary. And And then some of them were on wires and were flying and like over our heads. And I was like, get me the F out of here. This place is insane. Firstly, why is this happening?
So they were very in the Allen realm.
Yes, it was very, because then they had a battle up on the stage. Yeah. The demons and the angels had swords and battled each other. Yeah. And then Jesus dies and all the demons collapse.
It is clear, which you can kind of, when you know these theologies, which it can bother some people that there's so many, but let it be known that for most of the major events in Christian history, there are multiple theologies. Like these are interpretations of the same text.
Of the same text, they're coming to
very different conclusions.
Very different.
So when
But it is interesting when you can pick it out. You're like watching this play and you're like, oh,
I see what they're doing.
I know what's happening.
Yeah, they're you know, Thomas Aquinas-ing up or whatever, but it's like, you do start to see it. Now, a lot of this is denominational, so you might not notice it if you've ever been to the same church for a long time. Like, it probably is just your denominational theology, but that's also just one of many.
Yeah.
And that is something to note.
It is.
My second thing is, I have brought this up before, but it's, there's a NPR This American Life that talks about kid logic, and it's really very sweet. You can look it up. It's on YouTube. We'll put it up on the Instagram. But in the kid logic, so it's basically kids coming to certain conclusions. So one of them, quite funny in its approaches, there's a little girl who believes in the tooth fairy. And so she catches one day her father putting money under the pillow. And then she goes to her friend and she starts talking, and they see each other and it's like this like, oh, and whatever.
Yeah.
So she wakes up the next day and she goes to her father and she says, she goes to her friend and she says, you know what? This is crazy. You're going to think this is crazy. Now, what you think she's going to say is, there's no tooth fairy. My dad is the tooth fairy. And so she convinces her friend that her dad is the tooth fairy for everyone. But one of the stories on it is this guy who's not super religious, but his kid goes to a Christian school. So he's starting to tell his daughter about Jesus, and he tells the whole story, and, you know, he goes about it. And, she's quite young, and they go to a church and they see Jesus on the cross, and she's like, oh, who is that? And he goes, well, that's Jesus. And here's the other part I didn't tell you about. It didn't go as well as one might hope.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets really upset because she's like, oh, but he was so nice. He did all this stuff. Like, why did he end up like that? And she's like, he's like, well, you know, that happens. You know, he ran afoul of the Roman government or whatever. And then I fast forward to like a year later and it's Martin Luther King Day. And she's asked about Martin Luther King. And he goes, you know, he was a preacher. And she's like, for Jesus? Because she knows Jesus now.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, he's a preacher. And, you know, he sort of rubbed some people the wrong way. And at the end, she goes, did they kill him too?
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Oh, because they did. Oh, no.
But I thought it was such a thing of, like, of course these people couldn't live. I mean, I don't mean that, like, in a... they shouldn't have lived. I mean, anybody who's like this lives.
I mean, that's kind of why I think that this idea of the reconciliation theory, just being like, hey, it wasn't that God was like, the way to reconcile is death. It was like, if I come and I live the way that God, want humans to live, they're going to kill me. But it's still worth it to come. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of... how we should all be, is like, I'm gonna live with the risk of being Christ-like, even though they might kill me.
Yeah. And it's important.
Hopefully they don't kill us, but they've killed a lot of us. So
they have. They have. Yeah. And I think it's an interesting thing, too, to see, you know, who professes this and is in power and who is the oppressed. I think liberation theologians pick up on that a lot.
Yeah.
This was never a position to which you should be very powerful.
Right. I mean,
Christianity became the religion of the empire through really superstition, but it was never intended, I think, by the early followers to be that kind of powerful. And I think it really reflects on the sort of theological conclusions you come to if you are in power versus oppressed.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
So.
And I think honestly, too, that's one of the things that I find like you just said that when I used to like the Christus Victor theory most, it was because I did have a much more powerful stance, you know, like in the wrong way. Like, yeah, God is going to smite all of the enemies kind of way, rather than the like God is love and God is
right.
risking and God is sacrificing.
I mean, the Christus, it does do well for if you start to look at pre-Jesus humans, like, I mean, because I don't know that God incarnating and dying, I mean, does that go retrospective?
Well, in the Christus Victor theory and the penal substitution theory and the ransom theory, Jesus descends into hell and frees the Jews from hell.
There's a lot to unpack there. My first thing was just the Jews. And then it was like, I'm happy they're not. Why are they there to start? So many questions. Okay. Cool.
So it's probably not hell the way we think of hell. It was more like a
holding spot.
A holding spot, like purgatory, because it was,
we're all just,
you know,
listening on like an endless high school track. I mean, what?
I mean, if you think about it, like, did you ever read Dante's Inferno?
I did.
You know where Plato and Socrates and all of them, who he's like, they were great, but they weren't Christians. So they don't get to go to heaven, but they get to hang out in this like mid, except for everybody was like imprisoned in hell, and Christ grabbed the keys to the prison and he freed them.
Okay. So,
and so
did Plato and them get out of the mid, or are they still there?
No, they get to go to heaven. They get to go to heaven. Yeah.
So it's not just the Jewish people. It's everybody that's in that ever lived
in the mid area
and that ever existed on the planet.
No, just the mid area. So mostly it's the Jews, but
okay, cool.
Anyway, yeah.
I just had questions.
I think that's also this. I mean, there's a lot of theories that, because you know, in the Apostles' Creed, he descends into hell during.
Yeah, which
and so is so then when you're like, biblical. What does that mean?
Is there
what did he descend into hell?
That about hell?
No, not really.
Okay. So that's not there.
So, and so you'll see some people do take it out. Calvin took it out because he was like, that's not true.
Weird that anyway, I agree with Calvin on this one.
But yeah, when people talk about like, okay, well, but why did he descend into hell? It was because he had to get the keys from Satan, which is, again, that ransom, penal, Christus Victor, and then he frees them from hell.
So they get to kind of- not even a hint of that in the text.
Not a bit. No. Okay. No.
Just wondering.
That part is, in fact, made up.
She gave me one, guys. She gave me one. That one is in fact. I mean, it's sad because that's one of the nicer ideas, except for the fact that everybody had that hang out in this, like,
for like
2,000 years.
Yeah.
That's a while.
It is. It's a long time to be like, huh.
So, like, we didn't do anything. Just imagine if
we were like, Abraham was down there, and like,
Abraham's like, I was toast
listening. I'm the father of all of this.
That's right. I toast listen to the voice of God, and now right? I'm just hanging out just like on a freaking hamster wheel down here in the middle
just...
part. Okay. Cool. Well, I don't think I'm going to agree with that one.
I've always found that a bit suspect.
I've probably broken Christy's systematic. She's like, that one. Oh, guys, on that note, now that we've basically just uncovered and recovered all the mysteries of the universe here.
We have solved all of the problems.
We've solved everything. We just took one drink and we figured it out.
One drink and we have fixed the world. I was going to ask you what you are, like, if you have any current Good Friday or Easter traditions.
I still go to church on Easter. That's still same. A thing. And that's very much based on my grandma's. It was very important to my grandma that we go. And so I have a good church here in Charlotte that we go to. Good Friday, again, we didn't have the church calendars.
I know.
We would do the Flash and Play, I guess. But I don't really have any, like, I don't want demons flying at my face.
No.
There goes your social life.
The title of her sex tape.
Right, exactly. So I don't really have that.
It's hard to have traditions for Good Friday, I feel. I mean, I do go to Good Friday services as much as I'm able now, just because I've appreciated them ever since Glasgow.
Yeah.
But it is, like, what do? Just sit and be sad for a minute? Like,
I feel like...
It's a hard one to, like, develop traditions for.
Right. I feel like we're like Ryan right now in the skipping church, is that I'd rather just talk to you about this stuff, which feels like more of a celebration.
Yes, absolutely. You want to know what I'm doing for Easter this year?
What are you doing?
I'm going to go to sunrise service.
Whoa.
I know.
Luckily, my grandma didn't hold to that, because you all heard about my sleeping schedule, and that would not work out for me.
We used to go when I was a kid, because we lived in Colorado Springs, and there's this park called the Garden of the Gods, and a bunch of churches would have a, like, big sunrise service, and it's beautiful, so we would go sometimes. I haven't done it since I was a kid, but this church that I'm going to go to, I thought that their 10:30 service was a drag church, like, with drag queens. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I looked, and the drag queen church service is actually next Sunday.
Not
on the 27th. So I was like, oh, what am I going to do? But they're doing the sunrise service. And then I thought about it, and I was like, I could try for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, I think you've got part of the whole thing is just finding a church that, you know, in general, that you want to sort of
hear. Like, but you've got a good church in the...
I do. Watershed is
Watershed.
Good. Yeah, there's a lot of beer camp folks that are... Yeah. The guy who runs the sound is actually a brewer. He owns a brewery.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and they're great. No, I have nothing but good things to say. So we'll be going there.
Yeah, nice.
And I'm going to do church. I'm going to go to church as opposed to doing church. So we've talked about the difference between that.
Yes, which absolutely.
I think I need that on Easter. And we'll probably... We used to always go out for... It was actually a really nice tradition back in the day with my family. Easter was a big thing. We'd have the big meals and, you know, the potluck and stuff. And my grandmother would be horrified. My Southern Baptist grandmother would be horrified that it's 420. Well, actually, she wouldn't know what that
means. She wouldn't know what that means.
No. Not even. She was like a Depression-era grandma. She'd be like, what does that mean? And my dad would be like just giggling in the background. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So happy Easter, everybody.
Happy Easter. Our band book club is on the 22nd on Tuesday. So there's still a couple of days if you want to get on that. I'm excited.
I forgot how important that book is to the life we're living right now.
I know. It is
1984.
Ooh, 19. Yeah, it is an interesting read at the moment that we're in. Yeah,
it really is.
And then obviously sign up for beer camp, because it's early registration right now, so it's a little bit cheaper than it will be later on.
Stuart has surprised us by also joining the band book club. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see that. So yeah, if you want to meet
reading the book,
Stuart in the flesh, kind of. I'm excited.
I don't know if we're gonna be in the same. We'll have to be in different rooms. That's weird. Like sharing a Facebook account or something. I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right.
We will see you later.
See ya. Bye.